Everybody loves a comeback, a Cinderella story. But the results of last week's election, particularly the surprise approval of the sale of the Cincinnati Southern Railway, I'm sure left a bad taste in some mouths. And more fun news, though, Kings Island's parent company is merging with another amusement park owner to create an entertainment juggernaut. This is Above the Fold. Welcome to Above the Fold, a podcast by the Cincinnati Business Courier, where we bring you the week's top stories and interviews with the newsmakers that take you behind the people and personalities in the news. I'm your host, Andy Brownfield, joined by co-host and Courier Editor-in-Chief, Tom Dimeropoulos. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, Andy. Happy to be here.
So for our guest this week, we did something a little bit different. I think, you know, it's not the first time that a guest has brought adult beverages to the podcast, but it is the first time that we consume them while recording the podcast.
Well, it's an absolute must when you're recording, Andy. If someone brings, you know, adult beverages, you have to share and partake and taste. You have to make sure that they're good and you're knowledgeable when you're talking about these products.
Yes, more on that in a bit. And dear listener, I want you to pay close attention and let me know if towards the end of the interview you can hear us getting a little sloppy. So unless you've been entirely unplugged for the news, the internet, and social media over the past week, you probably know that there was an election that took place, and some interesting things happened the night of November 7th. Our politics reporter, Chris Wetterich, guest-hosted the podcast last week, and I asked him to handicap Issue 22, the ballot initiative asking voters to approve the sale of the Cincinnati Southern Railway to Norfolk Southern, the longtime and only user of that railway. He said that the initial polling had the issue very close, and that overwhelming sentiment seemed to be opposed to the sale, citing things like distrust of City Hall and the political scandals of 2020 that saw three council members charged with corruption, two of whom have both now been sentenced to prison terms. From my own anecdotal scan of social media and people I know, it did seem like sentiment was overwhelmingly against the sale. But, like Chris said last week, social media posts don't vote.
That's true, but you know, Andy, I felt the same way, and the reason I felt the same way is because I was hearing from two different groups that were on the same side of the fence when it came to this issue, and it was people who were typically more right-leaning, more Republican in their ideals, and also people who were on the kind of far left that are, you know, strong Democrats were against this, and that's not usually a union you see in politics where they feel the same way about an issue.
And I guess while it did engender strong opinions from the opposition side, it's not like a lot of political issues where if you feel a way about it, you feel very strongly about it. I'm sure the pro-sale people weren't exactly, you know, writing to their congressmen or, I don't know, wearing their support on their sleeves, putting up yard signs. I mean, as me and Chris talked about last week, the entire campaign in support of this came from Norfolk Southern. They put up $4 million to push this issue, whereas the opposition was more of a grassroots campaign.
And there wasn't a ton of money, you know, backing that opposition campaign. It was not a huge sum of money that was raised to stop this. It was, you know, some fairly vocal people who were pushing against it, but you know, in terms of consensus building and having a large group, I don't think that was the case.
Yeah, and even the people I know who were opposed to the sale, now that it is going forward, are saying, okay, well, you know, this is the reality of facts on the ground, and we just got to hold politicians' feet to the fire and make sure they do what they said they were going to do with this money.
That was one of the things I did see Wednesday morning, was a picture someone posted of the checklist that the city had kind of put together mm-hmm. for itself and said, all right, get to work, which, yes, hopefully this is the result, is that we have this, you know, this money, this fund that grows in perpetuity is the idea, and that we get a little bit more every year, and the city's better off for it.
Yeah, and you know, there's $400 million of deferred maintenance that this fund is supposed to help address, things like potholes, upgrades to fire stations. And I keep going back to potholes because I live in Norwood, and that's a huge issue, and it won't be addressed by this, and that upsets me.
Because you live in Norwood. Sorry, Norwood can just be part of Cincinnati. They can any time. I'm sure the city would be happy to have Norwood.
I would love that, but I don't think a lot of the old timers in Norwood are on the same page as me. In fact, our mayor in Norwood ran unopposed, which made me wonder, why didn't I run? So, I think that the sale was also boosted. It was supported. The since The Hamilton County Democratic Party came out in support of Issue 22, in favor of the sale of the railway. And, you know, I think that and a lot of candidates and issues were bolstered by the fact that Issues 1 and 2 were on the ballot as well. And they seemed to drive record Democratic, especially in an off-year election, record Democratic votes, which just aided anyone with the D next to their name or anybody who was endorsed by the Democratic Party. I mean, the sole Republican on Cincinnati City Council, Liz Keating, a moderate in her party and a moderating voice on council, she lost her seat. And a host of Republican-endorsed judges and school board candidates also lost their races. You know, I wonder what this means for next year's presidential election.
Yeah, you know, I don't have a good sense yet of what this means. Well, you know, Issue 1 brought out a lot of voters and in Ohio, and I think that showed that Ohio is not a red state. You know, it's not there yet. I think we, you know, Ohio bounces around still in terms of the national politics. But locally, I have talked to quite a few people and again, have read a lot of reactions about Liz Keating not making it back on council. And I do think that's a loss for the city, you know, to at least have some person who's not part of the majority party on council, I think is a misstep for the city. And I talked to a lot of people who are Democrats who have said, I voted for Liz because she's a good politician. Not just, you know, not regardless of what party she's in, she's just a good politician. So,
well, we'll see next year when the presidential election rolls around. I mean, for some context, some numbers, 3.9 million Ohioans voted this election, and that's about 800,000 more than voted in August, which is when Issue 4 was going to decide whether or not to change the threshold for amending Ohio's constitution, which was taking direct aim at Issue 1 in this election. You know, compare that to the presidential election of 2020, which saw 5.9 million voters, 2 more million more than turned out last week, or that's about 74% of registered voters. So Cincinnati needs housing, right? I mean, our population's been growing, but the housing stock has not been keeping up. Is that fair to say?
That's absolutely fair to say. You know, when you look at Cincinnati, this was a city of 500,000, 600,000 people in the 1950s, and we're at about a little over 300,000 now. So we've had more people in the past, and we can have more people again in the future.
And it would stand to reason that dense urban multifamily housing can be a good way to address that problem. I mean, constructing apartments or condo units in walkable business districts where people want to live near urban amenities like restaurants and shopping. It would seem like a good idea, but when it comes down to actually doing it, there are some community residents that aren't really interested in seeing that in their own backyards.
That's absolutely true, and I think this is a conversation, Andy, that's being held in just about every neighborhood right now, is yes, we want more walkable, dense amenities. We want the benefit of being in a dense, walkable, you know, location, but we don't want to have it in our neighborhood. Which is,
right.
is weird. It's a weird dichotomy to have.
It is, because you know the PLK communities, I don't know how to pronounce it, is the Isla or the Illa apartments right on the Wasson Way, something that was advertised or maybe derided as a tower, but you know, got a lot of opposition from residents of Hyde Park. In fact, I'm not going to name any names, but I know somebody who sold their house because it was being constructed near them. That kind of sentiment is also being lobbied against a new project in the O'Brienville Business District. Dial Residential is planning a $5.5 million 19-unit apartment project atop a 25-space parking garage on about 1.5 tenths of an acre near O'Brienville. And that project went before the Cincinnati Planning Commission last week for zoning changes, but the move was opposed by area residents. Chris Wedrick, again, he reported on people saying things like that traffic's already a mess and that, you know, 19 units seems very extreme to be fitting onto such a small lot. And, you know, another resident said that the city continues to ignore zoning laws as they exist, and this person called those laws outdated but said, hey, they're on the books, you might as well follow them.
Yeah, and again, that kind of gets to what, you know, what Cincinnati and other parts of the region want to be long term. Do we want to be a pro-growth region, which I would argue we kind of need to be long term. You know, it's competitive out there. This is a capitalist nation, and this is a example of haves and have nots. And if we want to be a have, that includes being pro growth and having places that people want to live and having enough housing for people who want to be here. And I think you're going to see the city push to change its zoning code to make it more inclusive of dense development where it makes sense.
And it's also just a feature of the nature of the market, right? So in that lot, 0.15 acres, you know, Dial Residential owner Christian Dial said that he looked at less dense townhome projects, but because of how expensive that land is to build on, he'd have to sell those townhomes for $600,000, $700,000 a piece, and he could fit a lot more people in there at much lower cost through a 19-unit apartment project.
Yeah, and then, you know, and then he's not building housing that's only affordable to a select few, a small group. And we need housing across the board. We need options, you know, from workforce housing all the way up to luxury housing. It's every, you know, every category could use additional housing units.
Yeah, not to bury the lead here, but commissioners ultimately did approve the zoning request, saying that they have to think of the overall city's health, not just single streets or neighborhoods. So, Tom, you're a fan of Ted Lasso, right?
I am. I have watched all three seasons.
So, through the course of working here, I've learned that European, or broadly non-American soccer leagues, they don't have playoff or championship games like we do in our sports. Like, imagine having the NFL regular season, but then no playoffs or Super Bowl.
What's the point in that?
I know.
How do you know who's the best?
Exactly. But that's what European soccer is like. After the season, the team with the winningest record is considered the best. And that's just it. They win the season.
I guess that's fine. I don't know. Part of me likes how, like in college basketball, you have the regular season champion. So you'll have the conference champion, and then you'll have the conference tournament champion. That's two different things. And honestly, it celebrates kind of two different achievements, because, you know, being the best throughout a season, you know, over however many games, 40 games, I don't know the exact number, sorry, basketball games. But that just shows, you know, you're good night after night. But a team that wins the conference tournament can just get on a hot streak. They could have a terrible record, or they could have a middling record, you know, kind of throughout the year. But for whatever reason, they click at the right time and they run through the conference tournament and win, you know, four or five games in a row. I like having both. I like knowing who's better throughout the year, but then also who wins when it comes down to do or die.
Yeah, and, you know, the American Major League Soccer, they agree with you there. I mean, they saw what the Europeans are doing. They said, yeah, that's cool, but how about we do a tournament too? So by European standards, FC Cincinnati is the best team in the league. It won the Supporters' Shield for having the best record in all of Major League Soccer. But it's also currently in contention for the MLS Cup, the ultimate award of the league. And that didn't seem very likely 3 years ago when FC Cincinnati joined the MLS, did it?
No. Partially because they had only gotten about 270 days to move up from USL, which is, you know, I guess the equivalent of AAA baseball, to the major leagues.
Yeah, which doesn't seem like very much time at all. I mean, I think I've dithered that long on what to wear going out at night. And so Steve Watkins, he wrote a cover story for us recently about this incredible turnaround, and not just the turnaround, but what it means for Cincinnati, because it's not just the team, right? I mean, remember, so we'll pull back the curtain a little bit. You know, we, as a paper, spend a lot of time thinking about the whole package of a story, and part of that's the headline, and we went with civics lesson, which it goes this idea of civics, or fans of a team who aren't necessarily fans of that sport, or watching every game that team plays, but they're fans of a team because they are part of the fabric of Cincinnati. They're supporters of the city of Cincinnati, so therefore they're supporters of FC Cincinnati. And that's kind of a broad-based support in the city that has followed the team not only as they have turned their momentum around on the pitch, but also as they grow their presence in the West End through not only TQL Stadium, but an upcoming $300 million mixed-use development that's, you know, it's not predicated on the team winning, but having that momentum behind them certainly builds the excitement for this development that is tied to the team.
Absolutely, Andy. So the thing I keep going back to with FC Cincinnati is, from the beginning, even when they're in their USL days, this was a team that people were just excited to go watch. And it was a thing to go support because it was uniquely here in Cincinnati. And their record wasn't great initially. It's not like they started in the USL and they were, immediately at the top of the league. But they immediately got it right in terms of filling that stadium and getting people interested in going to the games and making it a fun atmosphere and making it a fun thing to go do. And then they just built on that and built on that. And then when the wins started coming, it got even bigger.
Yeah, I mean, the only FC Cincinnati game I've ever been to was at Nippert, and I don't care about sports. It means nothing to me, and my day won't be ruined if they lose. But it was a really good time, and I did end up cheering for FC Cincinnati at that game. So, like I said, Steve's cover story doesn't necessarily delve too deeply into how they turned it around, but more broadly what it means for Cincinnati. It's definitely worth checking out online or in our newspaper. And speaking of FC Cincinnati, all the city's major league sports teams have betting sites affiliated with them, places at their stadiums or nearby where fans can go in person to bet on sporting events, something that only became legal at the beginning of this year. The Reds was inside Great American Ballpark before it moved to the former Gallo Park restaurant space at the Banks. And FC Cincinnati's sports betting site was at the craft brewery Taft's Ale House on Race Street and over the Rhine. Until recently.
Yes. Now that location in Over the Rhine is closed. And it's gone back to being a kind of a regular sports bar.
Yeah, it was run by Las Vegas-based Sportsbook. And the site at Taft's generated only $64,700 in sports bets in the 7 months of operation, and that's the lowest by far of any brick-and-mortar sports betting site in the entire state of Ohio. I mean, for context, the Reds site at the Great American Ballpark, that generated nearly $900,000 in sports bets in the first 9 months. And this is just in-person betting, right? I mean, you can bet online, you can bet in mobile apps. And Superbook, the FC Cincinnati-affiliated organization, they handled more than $10 million in sports bets through their mobile app. And that's just a staggering number.
It really is, Andy. And have you ever made a bet on
The only sports bet I've ever made was when I was maybe 8 years old. My parents took us to Keeneland, and I bet $2. I bet $2 on horses, and that's it.
Yeah. I was in Vegas a long time ago, and that might have been my only sports bet. I bet on the Bengals to win the Super Bowl. They did not win the Super Bowl because they haven't won a Super Bowl yet. And I also bet for the Reds to win the World Series. And that was the year they got to the playoffs. What would that have been? 2012, 2013, when we lost in the first round of the playoffs after going up like two games to none, and we still didn't make the still didn't get out of the first round. But that's been it. I haven't made a single bet since sports betting has become legal in Ohio.
How much would you have won if the Reds won the World Series?
The payoff on the Reds was good. It was like 50-1. It was a fantastic bet. So it would have hit.
Yeah. So, you know, I said the sports book, they handled more than $10 million in bets through a mobile app, but that still ranks in the bottom five among the top 20 online sports betting operators now active in the state of Ohio. So it's, I can see why. I mean, we've had both George Goldhoff, the former president of Hard Rock Casino Cincinnati, and his successor, the current head of the casino, on, and they've talked about just the atmosphere of sports betting and how it can bring people into their facilities, that it's more exciting than watching a game alone. It's more exciting than placing a bet on your phone. There's atmosphere to it. But apparently that is better applicable to a casino and less so to a sports bar, because nearly 97% of the $5 billion spent on sports bets in Ohio this year took place online.
Yeah, I just can't. I'm so risk averse, I can't imagine getting on my phone and making all sorts of sports bets and hoping that they hit.
Yeah. It's like the stock market, but scarier. So Taft's, for its part, is converting the former sports bar area of its tap room, which is actually a separate space, to a private event space that can be rented out for functions. So speaking of the thrill of betting, or just thrills in general, Tom, are you a roller coaster guy?
I am, but I've become less so in recent years.
Yeah, me as well. In my 30s, I just don't have the stomach or the head for it. I mean, I remember riding the Vortex, which has now been decommissioned at Kings Island, and that just causing massive headaches for me. Literally.
Yeah. The ride that gets me now is, and it's not even one of the bigger ones at Kings Island, is the Backlot Stunt Coaster, because it has that launch and then immediately turns you on your side and you do kind of a corkscrew up. And for whatever reason, that sets off like vertigo, and I get really dizzy when riding that.
Getting old sucks. But no, yeah, speaking of launches, I mean, for most of my life, I was not a roller coaster guy. When my parents would take me and my younger brother Joseph to Kings Island, my dad was saddled with me and had to go on gentler rides like the carousel. And it wasn't until a family trip to Disney World in Orlando, after, gosh, more than a decade of life, that I finally mustered up the courage to ride a roller coaster. My mom and Joe had ridden Aerosmith's Rockin' Roller Coaster at Disney, and Joe told me that it doesn't go all that fast, and you can't really feel it loop. He lied.
That is an absolute lie.
He lied on both accounts. It went from 0 to 60 in like 3 seconds, and I could most assuredly feel the loops. But yeah, that sparked a lifelong love of roller coasters, and I, you know, a love that doesn't love me back much these days. But locally, the indisputable best place to ride roller coasters is Kings Island, and that theme park's parent company, Cedar Fair, just announced a merger with Six Flags Entertainment Corporation to create an amusement park behemoth with 42 parks and 9 resorts across its portfolio.
Yes, this is a going to be a massive company when this transaction closes with, Cedar Fair, which in addition to Kings Island also owns Cedar Point up in Sandusky, which is probably the best roller coaster park in America. Although Kings Island, I think, is right up there these days too with the amount of roller coasters that it has.
You know, I've never been, but even though I've got family up in Northern Ohio around there, and you know, Cedar Fair was headquartered in Sandusky, but the new company will operate under the Six Flags name and trade as FUN under the New York Stock Exchange, but they're still going to maintain a significant finance and administrative operation in Sandusky.
And this really does feel like kind of a merger of equals as opposed to one company kind of taking over the other, because the leadership here from Cedar Fair is going to be merging with the leadership at Six Flags. So the CEO of Cedar Fair is going to be the CEO of the new combined company.
Yeah, it remains to be seen what the local impact will be. There's not really a ton of overlap between theme parks in our region. Not that, you know, it's not really like movie theaters where you can put one every 15 miles and they'll draw from different audiences. I mean, Kings Island is a true regional and even national draw. So we'll see what this means for Kings Island. I remember when it was Paramount's Kings Island, they had all that access to the intellectual property of Paramount, and when Cedar Fair took over, they lost a lot of that, but now Six Flags is gaining access to its own intellectual property for things like Snoopy.
Yeah, yeah, and you'll have, I think, is DC with Six Flags?
It is, so yeah.
Maybe we'll get a Batman roller coaster where the Vortex used to be, because that space is still open.
I might come out of retirement for that. This week on the podcast, we have Adam Bankovich, the new CEO of Rheingeist Brewery. Adam has been serving in the interim CEO role since April of this year, before earning the full-time position last month. He joined the brewery in late 2022 as its chief commercial officer, coming from the brewing behemoth Stone Brewing. Adam talks about what's new at Rheingeist, which is by far Cincinnati's largest craft brewery, as well as how it's handling growth while the industry as a whole slows. This is Adam Bankovich on Above the Fold. So, since this is kind of a first for the podcast, I want you to describe what you've brought here and kind of what this setup looks like now.
Sure. Well, coming from Rheingeist, I thought the right thing to do us justice would be coming down with some beers. So I have an array of beers that we've launched this year. All of them are new this year. So I figured if we're going to be waltzing into territory of what these years looked like for Rheingeist and what the future looks like, I brought some Cincy Light, which is one of our latest launches and innovation. We've got Kernza Lager, which is a collaboration beer we did with Patagonia Provisions, which is the food and beverage arm of the Patagonia that we all know. And that's a collaboration across the country with lots and lots of other breweries that are participating. So it's a purpose-led beer with a lot of amazing initiatives behind it. Juicy Truth that we launched at the very beginning of this year, the first line extension ever on Truth IPA. I brought Geist Tea Half and Half, which is our first line extension on our hard iced tea line. And then in the big can that nobody listening can see is Kiwi the Bird, which is a beer that just won a gold medal for us at Great American Beer Fest. and is currently available in our hot box to give a shameless plug. But it's timely and just won a gold medal and a beer that I'm personally very fond of. So I thought I'd bring that down as well.
Awesome. Exciting. Yeah. So I was telling Tom earlier that I'm probably going to crash out, maybe get a little sleepy around 3 o'clock today. As someone who works at a brewery, and I have to imagine part of your job is to sample. I mean, how do you keep yourself awake? Like, do you do the sommelier thing where you take a sip and there's a spit bucket, or how do you handle, you know, being around beer all day?
No, the way that I learned to taste beer, and I love our VP of production that taught me this as well, is you need to drink it to fully properly sample beer. The experience is different from wine, so it doesn't work that way. Twice a month, we've got innovation beer meetings that is basically the only time in the course of any work week, work day, where the job I do is actually what I think most people think I do all the time when I say I work at a brewery. Yeah. But it's certainly far more than just trying different beers. But those meetings are a lot of fun. We come in purposefully intending to taste certain things that we've been experimenting with at our pilot brewery, or things that we might see white space in that we want to learn more about. So we'll taste beers that we brew on our pilot system, or we'll taste beers that are examples in the market that we think are compelling and we could learn something from. So it's not too often that I actually drink beer during the course of a day. But when we do, we sit around in our sensory lab around the biggest Lazy Susan you've ever seen that our team of makers built. And the beers go around the table and we talk about why they're on the table and how we should evaluate them and give honest, open feedback. Obviously, it's all subjective. So there's a lot of different palates represented in the room, and all feedback is valid feedback. Sometimes if we're tasting something that the palates that are usually in that room aren't keen on, then we'll bring other people in. So we can bring people in from the outside or people in from elsewhere in the company that aren't usually in that room on a weekly or biweekly basis, because we know that everybody's different and looking for something different in the beverages they're drinking.
Yeah. So why don't we crack open one of the first ones here and tell us about it?
Absolutely.
That sounds great.
That's fun to hear on microphone. Yeah, I was wondering how that sounds. So we're going to start with Cincy Light, which has been a really fun ride for us so far this year, and it's really just kind of getting going. If you're unfamiliar, Cincy Reigns is the name of the NIL, Name Image Likeness Collective, that benefits UC student athletes. So they approached us in February of this year and said, well, first, sorry, cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Pause for everybody to get a sip. So Cincy Reigns approached us in February of this year with this idea that NIL Collective is this rapidly changing landscape in student athletics, and their whole mission is to do everything they possibly can to benefit student athletes at UC. And one thing that they wanted to do among all of the things that they're doing, which is a lot, is partner with a brewery to have a beer that's licensing their mark and representing what they stand for and benefiting the collective. So we were really into the idea, and we talked a lot about what they were looking for, what style of beer, what their goals are, how wide of distribution were they hoping to achieve, what would success look like for them. And we took a lot of information, and then I talked with our executive team about it and said, okay, here are the marks that we have to hit. They want a lighter beer that fits the need that they were prescribing, and then we need to make a beer that also allows us to make a contribution to the collective, because that's the whole point behind it. We passed through all of our checks internally, and everybody was really excited on board about it, which was really important to me because it needed to be authentic. Everybody needed to be excited about it. And if it was successful, which the early read is that it's very successful, we needed to be able to scale it. I didn't want this to be something that we couldn't take as big as the market allows us to. And so we passed all those hurdles, and the beer launched in draft on June 30th, which is a tremendously quick time to launch any beer product. We already have, for point of reference, we're 2 months now past the point. So we're early November, as we sit here and talk today. Early September, we'd set our entire commercial beer calendar for all of next year. So we know everything we're doing in 2024. So sitting there in February and saying we're going to launch a beer basically July 1st was a tall order. Everybody worked incredibly collaboratively and very quickly, but also delivered a high-quality product, both in the beer, the brand, the messaging, the design, the sales strategy to take it to market so that we could achieve the success that we're having with it so far. And it's blown far beyond our expectations. We're really, really happy with mostly the feedback the community's given to us around this beer. Everybody really understands that it's authentic, it's made here, it's benefiting the community here in Cincinnati. So that's Cincy Light in a nutshell.
Yes. say that's a beer that I tried at a bar one night, and then the next day went and bought a 12-pack because I was like, that is a good light beer.
Thank you. Yeah, that was our point. That was our goal.
Yeah.
It, you know, 10 years ago when Rheingeist was first founded, wouldn't it have been anathema to have a craft brewery brew a light lager? Isn't that just what, you know, better beer was supposed to be moving away from?
Yeah, it's something that's top of mind. It's really funny because brewers inherently love lagers, which is, this is a light lager. And craft breweries have long made fantastic lagers, but you're right. This is pointed directly at the light beer category. That's the space that we were trying to compete in that would fit the need that we set out to achieve with this beer. So we kind of had to acknowledge that this is distinctly different from anything we've done in the past. I like to draw the comparison where I think if we had done Rheingeist Light, generic light beer from Rheingeist, I don't think it would have been received the way that this has been received. I don't think it would have felt as authentic. Hmm. Additionally, we make tremendous lagers of all kinds and always have, rotating in and out year round, as do many other craft breweries. The other difference is that price positioning to the customer, whether it's on tap at a bar or at retail, wherever you choose to buy your beer. And those craft lagers are made at a different level of quality. And by that, I mean the malt that is sourced for them, or the amount of hops that are used in them, or the time that you let it lager in the cellar. All those things just add cost, and they are priced accordingly. So that's not to say we had shortcuts for this beer to make it taste inferior. We're very, very proud of the quality of this beer. It's just to say that a craft lager is distinctly different from a light beer. So when we went through all the iterations of what kind of beer would be best for this and how do we achieve the goal of the project, we had all that in mind so that we were designing the recipe that would allow us to work and price it competitively in market and not shy away from what it is, to your original question, right? Mm. This is a light beer made at Rheingeist benefiting the city of Cincinnati.
So I don't know, how did you first get into beer? I mean, did you come from a homebrewing background? Because you worked for one of the industry giants before coming back here to Cincinnati.
Yeah, and it, even when I was, so I assume you're talking about Stone Brewing, which is where I worked prior to Rheingeist, but I lived here the whole time. I traveled a lot, but I've been in Cincinnati since I moved to go to school here back in 2003. So I've been in Cincinnati more than half my life, all of my adult life. Hmm. My foray into beer began on a trip with, I planned a trip with a friend. That friend became the girl I was dating, became my wife that I've been with for forever, and I'm so happy for all of that. So the trip that we took was out west together, and it was formative because it's where I discovered my wife. So first and foremost, that sticks out in a really, really great way for me for that reason and the family that we've built together. But also on that trip, I picked up beer from a brewery I'd never heard of called Deschutes Brewery. We were literally just passing through California on our way all the way up to central Washington. And I was like, wow, this is really good. I like it. And I tried more from Deschutes on that trip. And then when I came back, it was just full speed ahead on all things craft beer. So I developed a passion, not from home brewing, but just from consuming craft beer, and I loved it. And then I was fortunate when I worked at the University of Cincinnati after I graduated, and managing Catskeller was one of the jobs that I had on campus there. And I had a boss and mentor, Amy Browns-Taylor, who was really, really, just, she pushed me to, or allowed me to push the program that we were developing there, selling craft beer to, you know, professors or grad students or community members who are coming into Catskeller.
So that was a bar inside mm-hmm. TUC, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, I used to go there.
Thank you. I might have served you a beer at one point.
Probably.
Yeah. So
you were there for 03 to 07?
That's when I was a student there. So then I managed Catskeller 07 to 09,
okay,
along with a lot of other things that I was doing. But that's where I really kind of cut my teeth on learning more about beer, building a program that would teach other people about beer. And that's where Cavalier Distributing came in, and they said, hey, we like what you're doing here. We need somebody to join our team and learn how to sell to Kroger, at the time was the goal, because they hadn't started selling beer to Kroger yet. I said, that sounds fun. I don't know what that entails. Neither did they, but we figured it out together. And there's a lot of people that I got to work with at Kroger who are still there, that it's been really fun as I've stayed in this industry, and so have they, to just kind of still be partners with them ever since then, when I was just asking questions, figuring out, hey, what's it take to sell beer in Kroger, especially craft beer? So I was at Cavalier for a while, and then Stone Brewing picked me up because they wanted me to open the Eastern U.S. for them, selling Stone Brewing to the chains on the East Coast. And I spent 9 years doing that and a bunch of other things at Stone. So it's been my entire career so far.
Yeah. So were you behind then? Because I remember there was an event at the Lackman. It might have been like the 12 Days of Stone or something, where there's like a green tea infused IPA and a bunch of different stuff that you couldn't really get in bottles around.
I was at the event participating. I believe Brandon, the sales rep who covered downtown at the time, was the one that probably set that event up. Japanese green tea IPA Stone does release from time to time. You can find it in bottles in their holiday mix pack. So they bring it back occasionally. If you're itching for that beer, it was a great one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what about the industry keeps it? That's a bad question. We've seen so much growth, even in the 10 years that Rheingeist has been around. And it seems like some of that growth has slowed a little bit in the craft segment, but it doesn't really feel like Rheingeist has lost momentum. How are you guys managing that? And you know, what keeps you excited about the brewing industry and about Rheingeist these days?
That's a meaty question. Yeah, the industry is slowed. Absolutely acknowledging that fact. Craft beer, you know, in its heyday was double-digit growth. I'm going to use air quotes that nobody can see. Easy to get double-digit growth. It wasn't, but there weren't a lot of options out there. Everybody was discovering it. The consumer was just insatiable in their demand. And now fast forward, there's nearly 10,000 craft breweries in the country, and so it's just a lot more competitive as part of it. Additionally, seltzers, hard seltzers didn't exist in the way they do now at the time. FMB, flavored malt beverage, is another segment of the category that is seeing tons of growth right now. And by and large, if you look at total beverage alcohol, beer, wine, and spirits, there's not much more consumption happening. So if you just look at all of it, and that pie is more or less static, share of beer has gone down, spirits has gone up, wine is kind of faltering a little bit as well. I haven't seen the wine statistics, so I'm not going to quote what their trends are right now. But within beer, first seltzer was rising, and now it's falling off relative to what it was doing in recent years, and now the FMBs are taking off. Imports, especially the Constellation portfolio of Modelo, Corona, Pacifico, those continue to grow and grow and grow. So anyway, craft beer is slowing. Rheingeist, fortunately, our beer portfolio continues to grow. Again, not at the rate that it once was, but the growth we have now, I would say, is almost more pronounced relative to the backdrop of the flatlining industry, which is really remarkable and something. Look, I've been here a little over a year, so I've had some time to shape, in my opinion, what I think we should do, but also the work that the people who've been at Rheingeist for 5+ years, and many of whom are nearing the 10-year mark, that's set up this amazing foundation that we have to be able to continue to grow. So what's the secret? I think it's a lot of things. We do, our marketing team analysis is amazing. If you're unfamiliar, a lot of breweries would outsource that, which there's nothing wrong with that. That's just a different business model. So we have an incredible team of folks on the marketing team that do anything from designing the cans that we're looking at to engaging on social media with our fans out there to selling the apparel, designing, selling, creating, printing, selling, shipping the apparel. Because when I would travel a lot for Stone, I would see the Rheingeist skull drop everywhere. Everywhere I'd go, I would see it.
I saw it in Sicily when I was in the airport in Sicily, and this had to have been back in 2017, 2018, maybe even earlier than that, but it blew my mind. I was like, there you go, Rheingeist in Sicily.
Yep, exactly. So the brand that we've created and the liquid obviously always has to be quality. You can have an amazing brand, but then if the beer isn't good or your experience with the brand isn't good, nobody's going to come back again because 10,000 options exist out there now. I think our taproom experience is highly unique, especially if you're somebody who travels the world, the country, going to different breweries. You're going to remember the experience you have at the Rheingeist taproom. And it's different almost every time you walk in. I walk in there daily and sometimes see something popping up there that catches my eye and excites me. And I've been to hundreds, I don't know if I've been to thousands of breweries, I've been to a lot. So we keep that fresh. We keep changing it. We've got this incredible old pre-prohibition space that we're able to turn over and create unique experiences that you can't have anywhere else. And that's different when you come back the next time. The people in this community specifically, we self-distribute in Cincinnati and Columbus. So our team that distributes the beer, whether it's the sales team or the team in the warehouse that puts it on the trucks or the drivers that deliver it, we have all these extra touch points. And I think that has gone a really long way in establishing ourselves in Cincinnati and Columbus specifically, where we're able to do that. But then we also partner with our third-party distributors, I believe, in a best-in-class way where they know what our goals are. we have dialogue with them around what's realistic, what's not, how can we better support them? Because at the end of the day, the distributors have huge portfolios that they're selling. They're going to want to sell what sells best, but also how they, the brands that support them the best. So I think that's gone a really long way for us. And I don't want to forget private events. We host, I think, 350 unique private events each year at the brewery. We have multiple private event spaces. And similar to your Sizzler story, I'll encounter people, maybe I just have a t-shirt on and they don't know if I work at Rheingeist or I'm just wearing the t-shirt, and they have to tell me, I went to my cousin's wedding there and I had no idea what to expect. I was not really kind of sure about a wedding at a brewery, and it was the best wedding ever. And they have this really positive experience that they take with them and carry forward and tell other people about, not knowing me from Adam. And that goes a really long way. So private events is something that we can do and do incredibly well that I think does have a lasting impact. So back to your question, that was a really long answer, but I think it is the accumulation of all these little things of how we do what we do and the people behind what we do and how long they've been doing it and how exceptional they are at doing what they're doing that have allowed us to stay relevant and find more paths to growth and being aware of what's going on around us and trying to get farther out and setting plans ahead of time to stay ahead of trends and know where our strengths are and play to those.
So Adam, do you plan to maintain that kind of event space in the building? Because I know originally when Rheingeist first opened, there was a lot of available space, and it seems like more and more of that space is being used today for brewing operations and other things like that. Where do you see kind of your physical space going?
Absolutely plan to maintain the event space and the taproom space and experience. The tank farm is complete. If you ever come down and go on a brewery tour, if you want to come down, it's incredible how compact they have all of the tanks set inside the brewing area. And if you haven't taken a tour or been down in a while, there are the tanks in the middle of the tap room that most people see, and that's what you correlate when you envision the tap room. That was just the original system that we put in place. We use it occasionally for smaller size things. If you go what we call the brew deck, but if you walk up the stairs and walk straight ahead past the merch booth, that's where the real brew house is, and all the tanks are set back there. And those things are packed in incredibly tight, and there's no more room to add. So we're okay capacity right now, but we're certainly talking about what happens if we keep growing at the rate we are. Eventually, we would run out because there's no more physical space. We wouldn't be able to take over the other spots in the brewery because it would take away from it being a community beer hall or a place to host amazing weddings. So solutions would be outside of the building we've got if we were getting to a point where we needed to add more capacity.
Yeah. And do you have that capacity in Spring Grove?
If we'd like it to be, yes. Spring Grove right now is where we do all of our distribution, and that's where our pilot system is. So we do still have some of the land there if we were to decide to make that land used for more brewing capacity.
Yeah. Shall we crack another?
I think so, yeah. So we're going to stay with lagers right now. This is the Kernza lager that we did in collaboration with Patagonia. So it's actually a very hoppy lager. And the cool thing about this program, well, there's lots of cool things, but when Patagonia approached us and many, many other partners around the country who are also doing this, they said, we'd like you to brew a lager. We'd like you to brew it with Kernza, which is a perennial grain that supports regenerative agriculture. Other than that, make whatever type of lager you'd like. And so some people have done pilsners, some people have done dark lagers. We chose to do a hoppy lager. But all the hops in here are organic. All of the malt are organic. The beer is not fully certified organic. That's a different, more extensive process. But we did source all organic ingredients to go into it. And it benefits. There is a revenue sharing portion that goes back to Patagonia Provisions, who's combining everything from the efforts around the country and then putting it back into developing more regenerative agriculture and supporting the farmers that are growing Kernza. And then there's also a component where each brewery, which is they're one brewery per region or state or whatever geography Patagonia Provisions kind of dictated for the radius of distribution. And we could choose whoever we wanted to give back to. So we chose the Ohio River Foundation for the first draft release of this. I think if we're going to plan to do it again next year, we could look at that again or look at somewhere else. But the point is Patagonia crafted this whole program in a way that allowed it to be flexible, both in the beer style and what the brewers wanted to do and how they wanted to interpret the grain, which is new and unique, but also how you give back to your local community while also giving back to their efforts to save our planet.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. So I remember early on hearing an interesting story about how when Rheingeist hired, they looked for a unique quality they called geistiness. and that it was a very non-traditional hiring method. I think every candidate got interviewed by anybody who wanted to interview them, or maybe by, I don't know if the team was small enough at the time, got interviewed by everybody. I don't think that's probably practical now, given just how big Rheingeist has grown. I think, what is it? Is it 25th or 22nd largest in the country?
23rd largest.
23rd. How do you maintain that culture as Rheingeist scales up and becomes this really massive entity in the industry?
Yeah, geistiness is something it predates me if we hired specifically looking for geistiness, but we talk about it a lot, certainly. So that's just our way to kind of acknowledge that everybody that works at Rheingeist has a sense of grit, and we're going to figure out how to get this done no matter what it takes, acknowledging that even though 23rd largest craft brewery in the country seems large, it doesn't mean we've got outsized resources relative to everybody else. So there's still this element. And I think if you come down and see the taproom space, like, you can get a sense that it is not a shiny brand new palace that was built as the Disney World for craft beer. It was put together and it still has a sense of what it once was. And I think that's in our DNA. So part of the geistiness to me is just acknowledging what we've got, and this is what we're going to work with, and we're going to do the absolute best job that we can, whatever line of work you might be in at Rheingeist, to get the job done within those limitations. I forgot the second part of your question.
How do you maintain that culture as you become such a large entity?
For me, that was something that was really important when I joined the company. So here I am, I'm coming in from a larger brewery. Not a lot of people at Rheingeist knew who I was. And when I was first hired, it was to lead sales and marketing, which were going well. We already talked about that. It was going well before I got there. It's not something that I did magically to make it go well. There was 9 years of it going really well before I got there. So it was really important when I joined to be very curious and inquisitive and spend time getting to know the people to understand the geistiness that I now have a much better sense of than when I joined, and how they'd been so successful, because I certainly didn't want to disrupt that. And so now, sitting here talking to you as CEO, it's kind of the same. When Bob and Brian asked me to step into the role, I did the same thing I did when I joined sales and marketing, which is find as much time as I possibly can to get to know everybody and understand where their strengths are, where the weak points are within the organization, how I can better support them, give them transparency and visibility to what we're trying to accomplish at the highest level, 3 to 5 years out even, maybe also at 1 year out, so they know what the most immediate goals are. And then acknowledge that, you know, going back to making it work within our means and our resources that we have, saying, yeah, it would be great if we could just invest, but we can't do that in 1 year. It just wouldn't work. That's how any business works. And I think making sure that I do the best job I can to give them that understanding of where we're at and where we're trying to go, and understanding and acknowledging the issues that they're facing and how I can help them and how the company can help them, how their teammates can help them, I think that goes a long way in preserving culture. If the culture is rooted in geistiness and we're trying to grow and scale and keep pushing ourselves to do more incredible things, the team needs to understand what we're working with. So that's been one way I've tried to help maintain the culture, even though we're larger now than we have been in the past. It's just maintaining what got us there. And that's not to say things won't change. Obviously, things have to change. We have to adapt. But doing it the right way and making sure people know if we have to change, okay, why do we have to change? Why does this make sense right now?
So, Adam, you've talked about competition and the fact that there's so many more craft brewers today. What does growth look like going forward? Because I think we've seen in Cincinnati a lot of our craft brewers have opened like multiple locations, but Rheingeist hasn't done that. What do you look for when you think about growth?
So we kind of talked about the different business units and the different things that we do. So I think growth looks different for each of those. So the easiest one for everybody to look at is just, yeah, tap rooms or the beers that you're putting in market that show up at shelf at retail. The tap room one is a really interesting question for me. I think it's really fun to entertain the idea of a new tap room location that we've never done. That idea has been floated around for a few years, but we're about to get really serious about considering it. But I don't have a specific answer to give you on what that would look like, other than the most important thing for me is maintaining that authenticity, the Rheingeist experience, which is unique. Exactly right. Yeah, you got it. So for the taproom specifically, I don't know which path we want to go. There's a lot of options. There's a million ways to do it. but I can say we're absolutely considering it and trying to be methodical and understanding, okay, if we're going to do this, how do we do it our way? How do we do it the right way? How do we do it in a way that resonates and adds something to whatever community we go to, and not just standing up a box that serves draft beer in a community where we think we might be able to do it? So I don't want to move too slowly, but I definitely want to be methodical about it. The commercial beer plan is no different. Next year, this is fun to talk about because I haven't gotten to talk about this externally yet. Everybody, are you familiar with Bubbles from Rheingeist?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bubbles has been around for a long time. Bubbles has also changed a bit over time, especially in more recent years. And we talked about FMBs, the flavored malt beverages, which is, I generally try not to mention other brands, but just to like help you understand what those are, would be like a Smirnoff or a Mike's Hard Lemonade or a Twisted Tea from Sam Adams. It's the things in that section of the cooler. So I'm not correlating Bubbles to them, but just in that space, we tried to take Bubbles to compete in that space. And that's when you saw RG Bev's launch. And we gave it a really good shot. The brand kickoff was amazing. The work that the team did around the branding was exceptional. And the liquid is really, really good as well. But the liquid did change to try and meet the consumer with what the liquid experience is in that part of the cooler versus what the flavor experience from Bubbles had been in the past. And we've heard a lot of feedback around it for the past 2 years. So we're really excited next year to bring Bubbles back to the original flavor experience, the original drinking experience that everybody had with Bubbles. If you remember Bubbles from years ago, that's what's coming back. It's going to go back in the beer section of the aisle. It's going to be back at 6.2% ABV. And I think, again, this is kind of, for this example, it's returning to our roots. We're going to have exciting brand kickoff that'll launch here imminently as we start to tease it. Although if you're a listener to the podcast, congrats, you have insider intel. But it'll appear on shelves probably the last week in December, if not the first week in January. And then we're going to have some fun extensions and new versions of Bubbles that people have never seen or tried before. And so we're getting through all that right now on sensory panels and doing the brand design. So I'm really excited for that for next year, for our commercial beer plan to lean into Bubbles and bringing it back and giving the people what they've been asking for very, very vocally with all of the positive intent, which I appreciate. Thank you. Via Instagram or other social media feedbacks.
Is that the beer that you've gotten the most request for, or are there others that, because for me personally, I miss the original Blizzberry variation.
Mm-hmm.
But
Bubbles would be number one. So that's the one we're solving for first.
Okay.
Yeah.
It sounds like just a fun industry to be in, something where you can exercise a lot of creativity. And I don't know. It's not a lot of industries where you can do something that you're really passionate about it and make a career out of it.
100%. Absolutely agree. It's creative. It's artistic. We have an incredible team of very business-minded, savvy people, because it's also a hard business, right? So there's the fun aspect where we can be playful and whimsical and artistic and create unique beverage or unique experience or taproom experience, all these different things, right? But at the end of the day, it's still a business in a hyper-competitive environment. So we also have to have a lot of rigor applied around to all of our financial analysis and projections and modeling and make the right investments and understand what that's going to do to the business. So fun, challenging, exciting, engaging, difficult. It's all those things. But you're right. I am very fortunate and blessed, and I do not lose sight of that I get to work in an industry that I'm so passionate about personally.
Excellent. Well, Adam, thank you so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. It's been great talking to you. Thanks for having me.
Above the Fold is a podcast by the Cincinnati Business Courier, hosted by me, Andy Brownfield, and Tom Demaropoulos. The podcast is produced and edited by me, and our theme music was written by Dylan McCartney. Come back next week for another edition of Above the Fold.